A brief history of the Holy Roman Empire. Hildebrand becomes Pope Gregory the VII. Upon the death of Pope Alexander II in 1073, it became clear that there was only one real choice for Pope. Hildebrand was a mere monk, usually considered the low end of the totem pole as far as being nominated to the papacy. But his power was undisputed by this time. People overwhelmingly supported the election, and he is alleged to have been swept up and carried by the people of Rome. As Pope, he chose the name Gregory VII after his old friend and colleague Gregory VI, who he saw as a sort of a martyr for reform. This irony made Pope Gregory VI, it's kind of odd since he'd been found guilty of simony, had been treated and interpreted in many different ways. Indeed, there are few people in medieval history or at any other time that have been as controversial as Gregory VII, Hildebrand. He has been revered as a saint, which he did attain by canonization in the early 17th century, but he was also condemned as an antichrist. His own friends spoke adulantly of him, yet one of his closest friends also called him Lord Satan. Gregory VII, more than any other man, made the High Middle Ages. Everything in it, good and evil, might never have existed were it not for him. He clearly and indisputably elevated the papacy far above the emperor and ruled as a dictator. He hoped to subjugate all Catholic kings to himself and had a desire to reunite the East and the West. Although the Crusades, which would not begin until after his death, the Crusades were originally planned by Gregory. He was the supreme power of the age. Still, his church reforms brought with them not only reform, but also decadence, but a new kind of decadence. Theological dissension could not be tolerated in Gregory's mind. Heresy, meaning anyone who disagreed with him, was the vilest of crimes. His militant means of enforcing his decree set the standard for later inquisitions, and literally created the church militant. However, the church would be referred to in two separate operations. There was the church triumphant and the church militant. Both terms were used by the church themselves to refer to the spiritual church and the earthly church. Yet this irony has not escaped many of its detractors, for the medieval church only rarely saw the two as separate. In the medieval theory, borrowed from St. Augustine, the heavenly church reigned on earth. The line became increasingly blurred over time. Even though Gregory VII, Hildebrand, had been one of the guiding minds behind restricting papal elections so that the lay people could not vote, he was truly made pope by the people. There is a dispute among scholars as to whether or not Gregory VII had actually asked for imperial recognition, but it seems that he did not. Gregory VII believed his commission came directly from God, and he would struggle zealously to reduce the imperial authority. Nevertheless, Gregory did not immediately concern himself with the emperor. The emperor was busy himself. Since Henry IV had reached age, he began to try and take control of the lands he had effectively lost, though still nominally under his authority when Agnes was regent, his mother. This brought Henry primarily into conflict with Rudolf, the Duke of Swabia, whose marriage to Agnes's daughter made him a rival to the throne. The two did not reach a treaty in 1074, but when the tomb of Henry IV's young son, who died in childhood, was desecrated by Rudolf's supporters, war again broke out. With the support of the people, outraged by the desecration, Henry was able to secure victory in 1075, and he crowned his son Conrad as heir, with the support of the German princes. As for Gregory, in his early days, they were divided between devising plans for a crusade, which he felt might be a step towards reuniting the two halves of the Roman Empire, and his, quote, reforms. In regard to reform, the promotion of clerical celibacy was a major issue which would come to the forefront in a few years. In the meantime, Gregory hoped to establish control over all bishoprics by requiring the nomination of all bishops be made by him, not a king, not a duke, not even the emperor. This was called the right of investiture. Which Gregory now claimed as his own. As for the Crusades, Gregory saw himself as leading the crusade personally, despite recent canon law forbidding a pope from bearing arms. Of course, Gregory often ignored laws he disliked, while creating new ones to support his own views. For example, as a monk, he was very attached to the idea of clerical celibacy. But the majority of the bishops throughout the empire opposed that doctrine. Bishops were married in virtually every city and county in the empire. The worst offenders, however, were the Milanese bishops, for they were second only to Rome in authority, and they resisted papal edicts more than any. Only the Archbishop of Milan, Anno, was a true friend to Gregory. Despite the great number of married bishops, the tide was turning in favor of Gregory. Ever since the previous popes had begun to promote clerical celibacy, a number of bishops took wives, after lawful but private ceremonies, to live with them in secret. They feared the long arm of the pope, but this did not give married priests an air of legitimacy. To the common man, it looked as if the priests had something to hide. Why, if marriage is justified, do these priests hide their wives and live secretly? Why is a wife hidden like a concubine? Although some areas, like Britain, continue to hold clerical marriage ceremonies in full view of the public, the secrecy of many priestly marriages played into the hands of the pope. Unlike the previous popes, Gregory realized that forming synods and condemning clerical marriage was insufficient. If a synod were unable to enforce its rules, What could you do? Ever since Henry III, the idea of clerical celibacy had gained significant ground and won support of Gregorian, or Hildebrandian, synods, but the majority of bishops throughout the realm, and in particular in Milan, ignored them. They asked, justly so, why, if this be true, did the idea of clerical celibacy not arise until the recent decades? Had not previous popes been married? Did not the priests of the Old Testament marry? Gregory's response was to forge documents in an attempt to prove that the clerical celibacy had always been canonical law. These documents were presented at a synod by 1079, and yet another synod, clerical celibacy, for the first time became canonical law, even though Gregory would convince many that it had always been so. This tactic showed Gregory's mentality. He believed his goals were noble, but for him, the end justified the means. If lying, forging, and even brute force was necessary for the final righteous goals, so be it. This attitude would soon turn on him, however. Even many of his closest friends would tire of his despotic rule, for forgery was but the first step. The synod would carry no weight without enforcement. Gregory then pulled out another tool for its enforcement. First, he commissioned all counts, dukes, princes, and kings to use force, if necessary, to enforce the decrees of the synod, to which Gregorian opponents had not been invited. He forbade married priests and bishops from officiating or performing their duties. Worst of all, he stirred up the uneducated peasants by warning them of the dangers of receiving mass from heretics, and threatened the masses with excommunication as well. The result was atrocities. Some priests were castrated by the mobs, wives were dragged from their home, charged with prostitution, or put in convents. Many bishops were driven from their lands and their homes, and the vilest sins were committed. Children were separated from their fathers by force. Contemporary sources mention many suicides by grieving wives, and mobs ruled the day. Even this was not sufficient for Gregory. He still needed direct control of the church and the bishops, which popes had never really had. By stripping the right of investiture away from the kings and the emperors, he achieved part of his goal, but he also had to make the clergy loyal to him and him alone. In the name of simony, Gregory also made it a crime for any bishop to earn a living or make money from any other source than the church. They were also to swear an oath of loyalty to him. T- to this too was to be enforced by kings and mobs. In only 2 short years, Gregory had done much of his, quote, reforms, but he had also made an incredible amount of enemies. His strong arm tactics and win by any means mentality turned many of his own colleagues into his secret enemies. So this is quite an interesting section, because frequently Gregory is put forward as this wonderful man and the man who really unified the church. But as you can see, he unifies the church by basically making himself king of the world, so to speak, and then utilizing the evil side of the church authorization. So we'll be keeping an eye on Gregory. There's a lot to come around here pretty soon. Now, the sources for this is Religion and the Holy Roman Empire by Ferguson, Before France and Germany by Gary, The Oxford History of Medieval Europe by Holmes, The Papal Encyclopedia by Bunsen, The Capetian Kings of France, 987 to 1328 by Butler and Adams, French History, Volume 1 by Guizot, Barbarian Invasions by Delbruck, Early Germans by Todd, and The Rise and Fall of the Holy Roman Empire by Criswell. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.